Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Side Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we are going to be talking to a young lady that is a soil person. She's actually a geologist. She comes from the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, a professor of geology, but she's interested in soil. Arizona, Nevada, West Texas, great place to study arid soils. But she looks at the historical soils, too, billions of years ago. So Brenda Buck, professor of geology, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Tell us, you know, nice young lady like you, what are you doing as a scientist? How did you move into a science career?
Well, I knew when I was 5 years old that I would be a geologist. And I grew up on a cattle ranch in western Montana. And I wanted to know why the mountains were there, why the rivers were there, why the landscape was the way it was. And nobody could really answer that for me.
So you looked straight past all the cows and the cattle,
at the
scenery.
That's right.
Because, I mean, you'd imagine you would have been fascinated by the animals, but no.
Oh, well, I love the animals, too.
Right.
And they were tied to the scenery. You know, why was the water where it was and the crops for them? So that was all, to me, the earth. And I wanted to understand that. And it wasn't until I was 5 years old that I knew that term was a geologist. So that's when I was able to actually vocalize it.
Wonderful. And so, therefore, this is a very focused career you've had.
Yeah, I've been fortunate to know what I've wanted to do my whole life. And I'm doing it.
That's a success story, I guess, right there. What was the first sort of original investigation that you did into your environment?
I was in first grade, and I found a rock out in the playground, and I started digging it up, and it turned out to be a giant boulder. And so every day I would have to sort of hide my excavation. And I got another student to help me, and at the end we were all the way down on our stomachs digging as far as our arms could reach, and we hit some sort of ant nest. And the ants came up and bit him in the ear, and his parents came to school, and I got in trouble. And apparently while I was digging it up, I was actually getting into the piping to the school. And so my first excavation failed. I was unable to get the boulder out.
No, but I mean, it had a lot of excitement.
I had a lot of excitement.
Stalag 15 or whatever.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Burrowing your way out of school.
And hiding it so that they wouldn't
know.
This
is great.
Every day.
And have you ever gone back to dig up things and been more successful?
Yes. Very successful since then.
Tell us then. I mean, obviously now we got a nice picture of this young lady just digging around in the dirt and thinking about why things were there. How would you say why it's important to study present soils and old soils? What's the comparison?
Well, there's so many reasons. One of the things that we do as a geologist is we use the present as a key to the past. So if we can understand the surface of the planet today and how things work, then we can go to the rock record, go to a cliff, and look at the rocks there and find out what happened in the past. And probably one of the most important things today that a lot of us are interested in is paleoclimate. Because if we can better understand how the Earth's climate worked in the past, hopefully we'll do a better job of dealing with our current climate and predicting the future.
So, in fact, then you look at the present, you've got a pretty shrewd idea of what's going on now. You then go to the past. But then you use what's gone in the past to predict the future, presumably.
Yes.
I mean, that would be the classic present, past, future.
That's the idea.
And how successful have we been in it? I mean, it's a relatively new science, presumably.
Yeah. I think we've been pretty successful considering the amount of time we've had to do this. We can read the rock record very well and understand, you know, when there used to be glaciers, when it used to be hot, what environment that rock was deposited in. And, you know, from that, reconstruct Earth's past history and how the planet operates and how the processes operate so that we can then help those who do climate modeling do a better job of predicting how those different processes work not only today but how they should work in the future if we change some things, for example, as we change carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Let's just talk for a moment about history. Is there any part of the world from the geologic record which seems not to have changed? I mean, we all know that if you look
change
here, we've got
constant
sedimentary deposits in El Paso, and, you know, we're 4,000 or 5,000 feet above sea level. Clearly, it was once submerged underneath an ocean. Because of the floating continents, there's not one place on Earth you can say, hey, this place hasn't changed, maybe
no.
The poles.
Change is constant, even the poles.
Right.
There used to be dinosaurs on North Alaska, so... change is normal.
It's normal. So, I mean,
yeah. It's understanding the rate of change,
right,
and what direction that change will move into.
I mean, is it fair to say then that there's always change, but there's always going to be types of climate that are constant? That is, okay, so you've got a North Pole today, which is, you know, cracking up. Apparently, the ice is melting. But, you know, there's temperate places that are getting warmer. There are warmer places getting colder. So there's a constancy of the nature of what's around in the Earth, but it's just changing in different locations. Would that be a fair understanding, or is that too simplified?
It's certainly simplified, but yeah, that every place on the planet is constantly changing in some form or another. And it can be just a short-term change that has to do with weather, or a much longer-term change that has to do with climate.
Right. I mean, that's one of the big complications nowadays, that people say, well, global warming, but this has been the warmest summer or the warmest
coldest
winter,
yeah,
or the coolest summer in the last 300 years. That's weather.
That's weather.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's your particular focus in terms of soil geology? Do you have one little passion?
Yeah, my passion is arid soils, which is huge. Because of that, I am really interested in how processes operate in arid soils. And from that, I can apply that to a wide range of topics. I've worked with archaeologists to help understand what the landscape was like, what, you know, the surface was like, the processes, the climate at the time that people were living or working there. I've worked with structural geologists to help understand earthquake hazards. If you can use arid soils to help date when an earthquake was offset. I've worked with dust in understanding how soils erode and lead to air pollution.
So it's a wide-ranging sort of discipline.
Huge. Yeah, huge.
But why arid soils? Why not any old soil? I mean, it seems to me those particular collaborations that you enunciate could be done with any old soil.
They can, but I focus on the arid soils partly because I went to school here at New Mexico State.
All right.
And partly because I love the desert, and I grew up in Montana where it's very cold, and so I enjoy working and living in warm places. And also I really feel that our arid environments have not been studied enough. There is a huge need for people to work in that field, partly because people haven't lived in extreme arid environments for the majority of civilization, and only more recently because of breakthroughs in our ability to live in those sorts of places.
Air conditioning.
Exactly.
We're starting to. And, of course, finding water.
And finding 5, water, yeah, and being able to,
underneath
to
the
bring
arid
it
area
to you.
Right.
Yeah. So because of that, there's a really large need for understanding those sorts of soils.
And presumably, arid soils are extremely much more sensitive and fragile,
yes,
than temperate soils, where you've got a sort of a rapid season of growing and dying and fertilization and et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. I think the other reason I like arid soils is they tend to record the geology better. The geologic processes can be stronger in an arid soil because there isn't as much life. Whereas if you go in the Midwest, a lot of the processes and the things that are happening there are biological. And so sometimes it's harder to see the geologic processes, flooding or dust deposition, because it gets mixed in with burrowing and growth of plants. Whereas out here, a sand dune gets deposited, buried, it's there, it's preserved.
Well,
and
give us
so
some
you can
concrete
get
examples of that, because, I mean, that's fascinating. Just
yeah,
pick
well
on one area of your expertise to describe what you've just sort of enunciated.
Well, I worked on my dissertation out here at Fort Bliss, where we excavated along fault scarps, and basically sand sheets would blow in and fill an area, and a soil would form. And in that soil, calcium carbonate precipitates. It's a mineral. And I looked at the carbon and oxygen isotopes of that mineral, which tell us what type of plants were growing at that time.
And what geologic time period are we talking
about? Yeah, this would be the last 20,000 years or so.
Okay,
so very recent, actually.
Right.
Yeah. So what happens along these fault scarps, they're topographically lower. And so a soil will just start to form, and then it will get buried by, in this case, sand. And so if I trenched through that, I'd have 14, 15 feet of a series of buried soils that were preserved. And I was able to go through and look at those isotopes, basically the chemistry, and look and see how the vegetation had changed through time. and be able to then also link that to how the surface out here in the Waco Basin has changed through time, where we once used to have a very flat, planar basin that had beautiful grasslands in it. And now it's composed of, you know, very large dunes with mesquite bushes on them. So that's how you could link the soils and the chemistry and the geology. In this case, it was geomorphology, but
well,
it all
let's
goes
talk
together.
A little then about the isotope ratios. Mm-hmm. Most of our listeners know that the elements come in a range of isotopes. They differ simply in the mass of their nucleus, the number of protons, electrons, the same. So the chemistry is the same.
Right.
But because of the heavier nature of some isotopes, the rate at which chemistry takes place, the kinetics sometimes is different. How do you use isotope ratios to discover the past?
Yeah, well, the most common ratios are the carbon and the oxygen. And the carbon is separated according to biologic processes. And out here we talk about C4 and C3 plants. And the C4 plants are the grasses. And the C3 plants can either be trees that you would expect to find up on higher elevations, or they can be the desert shrub that you find out in the middle of the desert.
That's before we carry
yes.
on. Explain C3, C4 for our listeners.
Well, it's just basically the photosynthetic pathway. So these plants are taking carbon out of the atmosphere, and some of the plants are basically able to pump that carbon and therefore result in an isotopically heavier signature. That's sort of a simple way.
And but the C3, the C4, this is just a different biological
It's a biological
chemical pathway,
right. Where that plant takes the carbon out of the atmosphere and turns it into the tissue, the food
okay.
for it, for the plant.
So then carry on.
So then the plant's body tissue has that signature based on that chemical pathway. And we do as well. If we eat that plant, then we are what we eat. And we can also obtain the signature of what we eat. So I haven't done this work, but a lot of geologists look at ancient teeth and look at the isotopic signature of what the teeth are to tell them what that animal ate, which then tells them what the landscape was like at the time that the animal lived. What the plants
okay,
were.
So
which,
whether it was more tree-rich or
right,
grass-rich,
and
et cetera.
Then you can tie that to climate.
Okay. Yeah. So wheat would be a grass.
I believe wheat is C4.
Okay, because yeah. I know – well, I don't know, so that's
yeah. – I don't scrubbed. Know for sure, but I think it is. Yeah.
Okay. So then the isotope ratio is different for C4 plants to C3 plants.
That's right.
And which is enriched more in what?
Well, the C4 is enriched in carbon-13.
Okay.
Versus carbon-12.
That's interesting. I think I should know more about this as a chemist mm-hmm. who actually uses isotopes in his work, but I don't know that. So while we're away, I'll go and check on my notes, and we'll be back in 1 minute with Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm talking here with Brenda Buck from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, a soil geologist. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. If you're a tennis fan, then you may already know that Venus Williams has Sjogren's syndrome, or SS.
The symptoms are quite painful. Dry eyes that perpetually feel like sand is in them, as well as a dry mouth making it hard to swallow.
It's the third most common autoimmune disease in America, where the body's immune system attacks its own cells. Yet, usually 6 years go by before someone is typically diagnosed, which is often too late.
By then, both the salivary and tear glands are destroyed, and you're left treating the symptoms. The obstacle has been that doctors don't have an early method of diagnosis, but now there is one.
It measures for antibodies that scientists identified in the blood, which show up early in the disease. Researchers found them by first developing mice with SS. These mice had elevated levels of the messenger RNAs that code for 3 salivary gland proteins.
Researchers then looked for and found antibodies attacking these 3 proteins. The mouse immune system was fighting its own proteins, the hallmark of an autoimmune disorder. Researchers found the same antibodies in people with SS, and at least one of the antibodies was found in over 75% of patients with early forms of the disease.
Diagnosing Sjogren's early could help doctors save a patient's salivary and tear glands, and perhaps slow the progression of SS, which is systemic. It can affect the brain, kidneys, liver, lungs, skin, and nerves. Patients also have a 5 to 15% chance of eventually developing lymphoma.
What causes Sjogren's syndrome is unclear. Genes may be a factor, or possibly a viral or bacterial infection. Nearly all patients are women over 40. The good news is the new test may be available this year.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Brenda Buck, Professor of Geology from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. So we've been talking about the concept of using isotope ratios, which can tell you something about whether you had grasslands, tree areas. That's one particular example, then, that we've been able to learn something about that recent history. And it's fluctuated a lot, I gather.
Yes, it has. Yeah. What we found was that, and I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but approximately 20,000 years ago was significantly wetter in this area, and we saw a lot of grasses in the lower elevations and trees in the higher elevations. And then we had a significant increase in aridity at about 8,000 years ago, and it resulted in the basin being eroded, massive erosion of this entire basin here, and the grasses go away. And so when the grasses are not at the surface, then the soil can blow away, which it did. And what reestablished were basically the desert shrub species.
These would be systems with more profound root systems. Would that be an explanation?
Certainly deeper taproot kind of systems. They are able to survive in a much more arid soil and an arid climate. We were able to link the 8,000-year-old climate shift to changes that are found all over the planet. Other people have done studies in every continent on the planet and found a climate change that happens 8,000 years ago. What we found here in West Texas and New Mexico was that it became more arid in this locality. And then it slowly became wetter and wetter up until about 4,000 years ago. So in other words, the grasses started to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw another period of aridification about 2,000 years ago.
Now, is that also a universal worldwide, or is that more of a localized?
Well, that's more local. There are sites worldwide with similar numbers, but it's not quite as well understood.
And that 8,000-year-old episode, do we know what caused it?
I think the Atlantic Ocean got colder, but there's something to do with the ocean circulation.
All right. So, I mean, it's the sort of thing that we're not quite sure what caused it. We know it happened. It can happen again.
Knows what caused it. The problem is this is a topic that's 20 years old.
Okay.
I can't remember it.
All right. What are you doing today? What's hot on the topic today?
Well, there's so many. But the one that I'm excited about right now is some research I'm doing in the Atacama Desert in Chile. We're studying the Atacama Desert because it's an analog for Mars. It's the most arid place on the planet of Earth, and so that's where we can go to try to understand processes that have happened in the past on Mars or may still be happening today.
This is up on the Alto Plano, or it's high up, or where?
Well, no, it's in an area called the Central Depression, which is about 1,300 meters in elevation.
Okay.
And it's, again, the most arid place in the Atacama Desert itself. Along the coast, you can get fog, but if you go inland, it gets significantly more arid, and that's basically where we're working.
I remember seeing in a National Geographic program, close to this area anywhere, where people would hang sort of steel wires out at nighttime.
That's right.
The air would condense on the wire, and then they collect the water.
Yeah.
This is that area?
Yeah, except we're inland where it's even more arid. One of the reasons I went there was to, again, study the most arid soil on the planet and how does it behave today, and are there features in that soil that could be preserved in the rock record so that I could go back into millions of years or hundreds of millions of years old rocks and recognize that those conditions at that time were also hyper-arid.
And we found
some amazing things. We found that pattern ground, basically where the ground gets sorted into these giant polygons, that which you can see on Mars and has thought in the past to have only be a process that can happen from ice freeze-thaw, is actually in the Atacama, where there is no ice and there is no water. And so we found that what's actually forming the pattern ground there is salt. and salt minerals basically heaving over millions of years are able to sort the surface and the ground into these giant polygons, just like freeze-thaw ice can do.
Tell me what size we're talking about.
Oh, the smallest polygons are about a meter in diameter, and the largest can be up to 10 meters.
All right.
I think there's some even larger than that.
Are these hexagons or octagons, or is it random?
They're different depending upon each surface, and we still need to do a lot more work to understand the specific controls on that shape, but they're polygons, basically.
And when you go down into the record, how far back have you been able to go and see the same type of climate there and soil?
Well, we actually haven't been able to do that yet because this is basically a brand new study.
Okay.
And now that we have some data, that will be the next step, to go back and look. I know other people have done research that have found these sorts of features, giant sediment-filled wedges in the soils, and have interpreted those to be paraglacial conditions, basically ice, back as far as the Precambrian, billions of years ago. But the problem is going back that old and still trying to find evidence that was salt there. That's going to be the difficult part. So we still have a lot of work to do before we can take this research from the modern surface back into the rock record.
And the salt is localized in these fissures where the polygons are?
There's salt in the fissures, but the entire soil is cemented with salt. There's so much salt there. It's unbelievably hard. It's a whole series of different minerals, halite, which is table salt, sodium nitrates. In fact, the area that we are studying are parts of nitrate mines, where the Atacama is very famous for the nitrate. And then there's a whole series of different sulfate minerals, thanardite, glauberite, gypsum, and hydrite.
Okay, so it's not a particular generic form. It's everything.
All kinds of really exotic salt
minerals. I was going to say, are there any exotic metals there?
There's a lot of copper there. they're mining.
A lot of copper.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, to mine copper, you need big facilities. And there's no water there. So this is how do they get water up to this location?
Well, the site that we worked at, they're not mining copper. They're mining the nitrate.
Mm-hmm.
And you truck it in, just big equipment. You bring everything in. We had to do the same. We had to bring in our own water and get through the weeks that we were working.
So this is, in fact, then quite an economic gold mine, if I can use the wrong expression.
Oh, yeah.
Right, for the area.
You bet, yeah.
And they're very happy to see you down there? I mean, what do they think about all these?
I don't think that they even noticed. We were just a couple of people in the middle of nowhere looking at rocks. We were probably very strange.
All right.
Yeah.
And how long do you down there?
A couple of weeks.
So you
just
camped
out, in the middle of nowhere, and I bought a generator and a diamond blade saw so that we could actually extract the samples because they're so cemented. And my students and I, we used climbing gear to get down old excavation pits that mining companies had opened, because without really large equipment, you can't even get into the surface. It's so cemented.
All right.
It's basically rock hard.
So you just go down, you collect your samples, and then you bring them back for modern analysis.
That's right, yeah.
And what techniques do you use?
All sorts of techniques. We use a scanning electron microscope to zoom in and look in detail. We use an X-ray diffraction to look at the mineralogy. And we do a lot of usual soil analyses. What's the pH? What's the texture?
Right. Are there carbonates down there?
Very few carbonates.
All right. So there's not been much in the way of life forms down there.
Yeah. In fact, that's an important point. You need to, sort of the recent research shows that you need to have life in order to form the carbonates in the soil.
Right.
And the area we're working on is so arid there's not even bacteria in the soil. They've been having a hard time finding live bacteria. And then we went to an area that was just a little bit wetter, but still extremely arid, and we found cyanobacteria living in the gypsum mineral itself. And so this is another interesting thing for finding life on Mars. It's an area on the planet where it's too arid for life to exist, and yet these cyanobacteria are actually able to live there because the salt mineral is able to pull water out of the atmosphere. The water is attracted to the salt, and then the cyanobacteria are able to take the water and live. And so they live a few millimeters into the salt at the surface. That way light can shine through, they can do their photosynthesis, and they can still live where it's too arid, normally for them to live, but because the salt mineral is there, they're able to get the water they need.
What particular salt? Just, again,
in
is
this
it,
case,
it
was
generic.
Gypsum, but halite, gypsum. Anything would work. Salt in general attracts water out of the atmosphere.
Okay, so then what's your sort of prediction for when we finally get cracking on Mars and
well,
move stuff back?
Yeah, Mars is full of salts.
What's the humidity in this region?
Oh, well, it's less than 1% in where we're
in
working in the Atacama, yeah.
And yet that 1% is sufficient to get a thriving colony of cyanobacter.
In the salt mineral,
right.
Yeah. And the mineral also protects the cyanobacteria from UV radiation because they're a few millimeters in the mineral. So the analog to Mars is as Mars became more and more arid, and if there was life on the planet, the last place that life could have existed would perhaps been these salty areas. And so that might be a place to look for fossil life.
But the bacteria need a lot of carbon.
Well, that would be bacteria. These are cyanobacteria. They do photosynthesis.
Okay,
so they get the carbon out of the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
And in Mars, one assumes that there's enough CO2. I mean, I don't know what they've analyzed in Mars.
Yeah. Mars has a much more complicated problem, I would say, than the CO2 as far as life to exist. And that's the nitrogen. And I don't know a lot about this topic, but I don't believe that there's much nitrogen on that planet. So unless there was in the past, that would be a big problem for having life as certainly as we know it here on Earth.
So I can see someone writing proposals to go and put fertilizer on a small part of Mars and come back every decade and see what's happened. And what other locations are your group working in right now?
Well, I just came back from Australia on a field trip this summer. We're not doing research there, but went down to see what research is being done in Australia and compare it to the work we're doing in the Atacama or
in
the Mojave.
That sounds like a boondoggle. I mean, that just sounds like you went there to just a site visit and that was it?
Well, it was a field trip. It was a pretty rough field trip. We got stranded in the desert. It was freezing cold and had lots of adventures.
I mean, that's one part of the world that really is having tremendous problems right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if it's global warming or what it is, but I mean, they've had the fires that decimated much of Sydney. They've had a lot of big dust storms from dust way in the interior coming out and covering, in fact, Sydney
again. Huge drought in that, basically the whole continent. Yeah.
And then there's just that little periphery where people live. Right in the middle, there's not much.
That's right. And we knew that when we were stranded out there with and our leader had both satellite phones in at the bar and we were stuck out in the field. So
was he an Australian?
Yes, he was an Australian. Yeah, I wouldn't call it a boondoggle.
No.
We paid for our trip.
But you all got back safely.
We did get back safely.
All right.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of fun and it's a little bit dangerous.
Yes.
That adds to, of course, the reason why people do science.
That's right.
Well, you came back successfully and you seem to have a lot of life in you. So Brenda Buck, Professor of Geology from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. Thank you, Norma Martinez, and we'll be back next week with some other talk about science. Bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. A $48 million construction project at Fort Bliss has been completed. The newly primed 320-acre site is where the new $1 billion William Beaumont Army Medical Center will be located. The project included the installation of an electrical substation and a 300-foot-long bridge that will connect to the adjacent highway. Read more at mcasynapse.org.